It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A ruling this week by the Wisconsin Supreme Court says that Governor Evers was in the clear to legally ban conversion therapy for LGBTQ plus people because a state legislative committee overstepped its authority to block a state agency rule.
Conversion therapy is a scientifically discredited practice, using therapy to try to convert people to traditional gender expectations. The Human Rights Campaign calls it a dangerous practice, targeting LGBTQ youth.
Here in Wisconsin in 2021 and 2023, a Republican-controlled legislative committee blocked a state agency rule. Now the state Supreme Court says that move was unconstitutional.
To learn more about the ruling and its implications on the balance of power in state government, we're joined by Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR State Capitol reporter. Anya, welcome back.
Good morning.
So at the heart of this case, it involves rulemaking, including this one rule involving a ban on conversion therapy. What does the 4-3 ruling by the high court mean for conversion therapy?
Yeah, it's a little wonky, but the ruling basically fundamentally alters how the legislature oversees rules in general. So those are basically directives about how laws are to be administered. And so in the case of the conversion therapy question, there are laws about how professions must be licensed in the state of Wisconsin for therapists or marriage counselors, things like that. There's an ethics code. And so the Evers rule adds a ban on conversion therapy to that ethics code. So if you're a therapist who practices conversion therapy, which you just described, you'd be in violation of that code. It's something that could cost you your license. What this ruling does is it prevents rules like that from being overseen by one legislative committee, the Joint Committee for Reviewing Administrative Rules, a very aptly named committee. There were a number of laws governing how that committee could object to rules like the one banning conversion therapy, and the court found that the way that they did that was unconstitutional. So this has really wide-ranging effects, basically remaking that whole rulemaking process.
So before we look into the check on this particular committee's powers, can you talk more about conversion therapy and its timeline? You know, when was a statewide ban on conversion therapy in effect in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Evers proposed that rule banning conversion therapy, again, adding that to the ethics code for therapists, when he first took office in 2019. When it went before that joint committee, they suspended it from going into effect. That happened in 2021, and then the same process happened again in 2023. And so essentially, it allowed this committee to kind of shelve that rule from going into effect. It then did go before the legislature through a different means. Again, we're in a slightly wonky territory, but the overall effect of that means that the ban did go into effect statewide in April of 2024. So technically, there is that rule in place, the Evers rule. So what this ruling wanted to kind of look at, or what the court case wanted to look at, was whether that process by which that committee blocked the ban from going into effect over the course of about 3 years was constitutional. And what the ruling says is that that process by which the committee held up the rule, it gave a small committee and just a handful of lawmakers the power to have basically statewide influence and to block a state agency from doing its job. And they said that's unconstitutional.
Let's look into the arguments by these justices. Chief Justice Jill Kroski wrote for the court's majority in this opinion. What did she say about bills going through chambers and the power of a committee to stop something?
Yeah, so again, we are in wonky territory here, but very consequential wonky territory. So they've ruled that current practice means that this small committee, as I mentioned, has such wide powers that it affects the legal rights and duties of those outside of the legislative branch. And so what they said was that if the legislative arm is affecting people outside of the legislative branch, they have to follow fundamental legislative processes. So those processes are familiar when you watch a bill become a law. Like, first it has to go before both chambers of the legislature, and then it has to be signed by a governor. That's how a bill becomes a law. And so what this ruling says is that the committee's powers are such that they triggered a similar requirement when it comes to rules, and that if they're not going to follow those same principles, when their actions have such wide scope, then they don't have the power that they've been given. And so the effect of this Again, it's complicated, it's technical, but the effect of this is to take power away from that legislative committee and move it into the executive branch.
Meanwhile, Justice Brian Hagedorn, who is sometimes a swing vote on the court, he says this decision raises more questions than answers. What did Justice Hagedorn mean by that?
Yeah. So again, the overall effect of this is the court basically said, the majority said that it is unconstitutional for this committee to object to and suspend a rule, that that's too much power for one small committee. Hmm. And what Hagedorn says is that that shifts the boundary lines of the branches of government, but not super clearly. And so he essentially questioned, where does this put rulemaking? Is that in the executive branch? Is it in the legislative branch? And who's in charge of which aspects of what parts of rulemaking, and where does the judiciary fit in? So he raises all these questions, and he says the majority opinion raises those questions but doesn't answer them. The majority says we don't answer those questions because that was not part of the case that was brought before us. And so legal experts that I've spoken to have said those are kind of all the obvious next questions that will be coming before the court as a result of this case.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is with us, WPR's State House reporter, explaining the nuances out of a state Supreme Court ruling this week. So, Anya, how are lawmakers reacting to this? What have you heard around the Capitol?
Yeah, you know, sort of mixed. One of the response in the dissent is that from conservative justices is that this is actually a politically motivated answer, right? So it's empowering a Democratic governor over a Republican legislature. And so the political responses have kind of been in line with that. So Democratic lawmakers have more or less welcomed this. They say that this ensures that a handful of lawmakers aren't making statewide policy, that that's supposed to go before, you know, the fully elected bodies, and kind of aligned groups as well, as LGBTQ groups, environmental groups also welcomed this decision sort of on those grounds. And then the GOP-held legislature was obviously sort of less than happy, as this strips them of quite a bit of power. And so them and also some of their aligned groups, including things like industry lobbies, really kind of rejected this decision. They said, again, it moves too much power into the executive branch. Some people refer to it as like a kingmaking decision, and essentially handing the power of the legislature over to bureaucrats.
And leaping ahead on this ruling, how might this decision affect other attempts by a legislative committee or other attempts by Governor Evers to, you know, on environmental regulatory rules or vaccine requirements, for instance?
Yeah, I think those are actually some of the really big areas where we will see this play out. There's, I think, a reason that so many environmental groups and, like I say, industry lobbies kind of weighed in on this, because things like cleaning up PFAS contamination, a lot of that is often administered through the rulemaking process, not necessarily the full legislative process every time. And so it does have all of these kind of downstream effects. And so what this could do is basically make it more possible in the short term, while Governor Tony Evers is the executive, for his branch of government, his state agencies, to be kind of implementing these policies of a Democratic executive. Obviously, that could change, because this is going to have far-reaching effects, no matter who is in charge of the legislature and who's in charge of the executive branch. And so I think we will see it play out, again, in these kind of like wonky ways, most of which won't necessarily rise to the level of something like conversion therapy, which is such an emotional issue. It'll affect things like building codes and state licensure for professions, you know, across the board. So it'll have very wide-ranging effects.
I wonder if we're inclined to see a lot more rulemaking by state agencies, you know, after this ruling.
I think that is one of the questions. And again, legal experts that I spoke to said that rulemaking is actually so much of where kind of lawmaking, quote unquote, takes place, because we have gridlock in our actual legislative bodies. And so things end up going through the rulemaking process because it's a little bit faster, it's more nimble, and it's also much more specific, right? So the law can say professions have to be licensed, but the very specifics of what those licenses look like, you know, the Assembly and the Senate can't convene every time they need to figure out like what a hairdresser needs to do to get a license in the state of Wisconsin. And so I think it's just really shined a light for me in particular, but into just how important and how significant rulemaking is. And so we'll, continue to see specific kind of honing in on this, the exact division of power that goes into rulemaking.
So the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to take up a case next term that challenges Colorado's ban on conversion therapy. What are you watching for out of the nation's high court and how it might affect what's happening here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that'll be interesting. And again, you know, when we talk about this division between rulemaking and lawmaking, one of the other things kind of affecting conversion therapy here in Wisconsin is that we have many local ordinances that ban the practice already. And so there's both the Evers rule that's in effect, there's these local laws that are in effect. And so this ruling out of the U.S. Supreme Court, when it does come down the line, could have, again, sort of wide-ranging impacts on this one particular component. And so that'll be really important to kind of pay attention to how that affects the ability of Wisconsin lawmakers and executive to kind of be regulating or looking into that practice.
Do you expect Republicans to repeal the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision to the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, it's unclear. I do think a lot of these questions, this is the third really significant ruling out of this court about the division of power and the separation of powers in Wisconsin. So we've been seeing a lot of these questions come before the court. And interestingly, not always in a 4-3 decision. So this one did seem, you know, quite politically divided between sort of liberals and conservatives, but not always. And so we're seeing a lot of those questions get raised here. And so it'll be interesting to see at some point whether the Republican legislature does want to kind of elevate some of those questions, because we are currently, I think, living through a really interesting reshaping of the branches of government in Wisconsin. And so, as Hagedorn said, there are all of these questions that were raised by this ruling and not necessarily answered. And so I think certainly we're going to watch them sort of get answered in the lower courts here and then maybe eventually try to get elevated.
Anya, thanks for helping us understand this. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk. We discussed Tuesday's State Supreme Court 4-3 ruling that found the powers granted to the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules had violated the state constitution.
Coming up, Wisconsin has seen a jump in deaths from alcohol-related liver disease, with younger people than usual driving that trend. We'll look at possible causes and efforts to turn things around.
It's really important for people to understand that 2 to 3 drinks a night can put you on the path to destroy your liver.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. New research finds that deaths related to alcohol-related liver disease are on the rise, with deaths from alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver in Wisconsin jumping by 35% through the pandemic. That's from an analysis by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel using data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Nationwide, the rate of people dying of liver disease from alcohol abuse increased nearly 9% from 2018 to 2022. And the rate of younger people, particularly younger women, dying from these liver diseases grew faster than other categories.
So what's driving these disturbing trends and what could reverse them? Dr. Patrick Remington is an emeritus professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Maureen Buzalaki is director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Remington, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Dr. Remington, let's start with you. We see this national jump in these alcohol-related liver problems, and the Journal Sentinel broke down the numbers. It's happening here in Wisconsin, too. What's going through your mind as you see these numbers? What could be driving this?
Well, these are based on death certificates, and that data is very accurate, especially for younger people. When someone dies, the physician of record then completes the death certificate. It's provided to the county, to the state, and eventually to the CDC. And the researchers in Illinois looked at those records and see disturbing trends. The rates were pretty constant, up until about 2010. Then they began increasing slowly, maybe 5% per year, but then really dramatically increased in the last 4 years as COVID approached, particularly for younger people and for women.
Maureen, you've said elsewhere that the Medical College of Wisconsin's liver transplant team is also seeing younger patients needing liver transplants related to alcohol consumption. So that, on top of these death statistics, what does that make you worry about? What does that make you watch for when it comes to younger people and their alcohol consumption?
Yes, when we've talked to providers, they say that it used to be they would never treat someone for alcohol, hepatitis, or cirrhosis, in their 20s or 30s, and now it's not infrequent. So we look at overall drinking trends and what is happening with the population and, you know, obviously the culture around that and policies. And what we see is young adults drinking less overall. However, we're finding that there's a segment that are drinking much more. And when I talk to providers, they mention that it's really important for people to understand that 2 to 3 drinks a night can put you on the path to destroy your liver.
Maureen, I want to dig into that a little more. I see those big picture statistics all the time that show fewer people in middle school and high school are drinking. Fewer people in college are drinking. Overall binge drinking numbers seem to be trending down. But what is happening with this group that you're pointing out apparently must be out there, people who are defying those trends, I guess, and drinking a lot more?
Yes. So they reclassified folks that are in the category of high intensity drinking. So we do see that segment. But we also see, especially, you know, with COVID, the mental health crisis and lack of, you know, enough providers, you know, everywhere to help deal with those issues. We see that people are self-medicating potentially, and that they're drinking in higher rates than, you know, they're surrounded by people that are drinking more. And so it's the norm, you know, we see across Wisconsin to be drinking, you know, on a regular basis at higher rates than you see in a lot of the rest of the nation.
Dr. Remington, you and I have talked a lot about public health and alcohol over the years. What do you think about when it comes to interventions, to outreach for this group we're talking about, young, high-intensity drinkers who are apparently at a very elevated risk of diseases we used to associate with long-term older drinkers?
Well, it's a great question. These are observational data. So these are data collected routinely. And the analysis is very sound. This is clearly happening. So it's not a question of whether this might be happening. It is absolutely happening. We are seeing more people developing and dying from alcohol-related liver disease, a really serious problem in Wisconsin and in the nation. And as a public health physician, I always think about going upstream, basically thinking, well, those are increasing death rates. Why? Increasing rates of alcohol use, problem alcohol specifically, problem alcohol drinking, as Maureen said. But then the question is why? We know that COVID and the isolation related to COVID and the stress and strain of unemployment and other things was a cause. And in fact, it's interesting, in the last year, you see a slight decrease in these statistics. We also know that there's a mental health crisis in our nation, and particularly in children and young adults. And alcohol can be used to self-medicate, not appropriately, by the way. It's an attempt to really blunt the pain that comes from depression or anxiety. And that use of alcohol as to self-medicate for mental health challenges is absolutely more harmful to health. And so I think understanding the cause is really important, but then, you know, not just talking about the problem, really going towards solutions, understanding why some people, why some young adults are problem drinking, and then address that individually. What are the causes for each individual? And that's going to change from person to person. It's the reason you need to be in close touch with a physician or a mental health provider to work on those issues specifically for yourself.
And Maureen, along the same lines, you at the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project, what kind of interventions are you thinking about trying to reach out to this group that seems to be waving a pretty big red flag in these numbers we're talking about?
Right. Well, I think it's important to people to understand that even drinking in what might be considered in Wisconsin a little bit less is maybe not as low as you need to go to really reduce your risk. So that's one piece. And I think what Dr. Remington shared is really critical in that. We focus on working on community changes and changing the alcohol environment. What we see are a number of communities that are doing a lot to reduce underage and excessive alcohol use during festivals and, you know, when they have temporary picnic licenses and those kinds of things by putting in safeguards, by reducing the number of alcohol drinks you can buy, by reducing the size of those alcohol drinks. So many communities around our state are taking measures such as those, which are helpful, as well as performing alcohol age compliance checks. So that means that they're working with retailers to make sure they're not selling to people who are underage. And that's important because we know, you know, first of all, when a kid goes in and is able to obtain alcohol, I think that's an important moment to not sell to those kids. And it sends an important message about community norms. But secondly, it also means that that retailer is, you know, not doing anything special. They're just following the law. And it's a really important law to follow in terms of the trends that we see. In Wisconsin, 1 out of 6 children have started drinking alcohol under the age of 13. And that sets you up for, you know, a lot of problems down the line. And so trying to change that culture by making sure that laws are being enforced, that retailers are on board, you know, and that community events are not sort of flaunting, you know, excessive alcohol are all pieces that I think can come together to help change that norm.
We're talking to Maureen Buzalaki with the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin and Dr. Patrick Remington, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at alcohol and increase in young people dying of liver disease associated with alcohol consumption and what we can do about that. Okay, so far, a lot of this conversation could be anywhere in the country. Let's look at Wisconsin in particular. Dr. Remington, there's a sense, and I think the perception matches reality pretty well, that Wisconsin has a particular culture, a particular issue. When it comes to alcohol, what do you see from your public health perspective?
Well, I started working with a survey that's done through the CDC called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. It started in the early 1980s, and pretty much every year in the last 40 years, Wisconsin has topped the ranking of problem drinking, of binge drinking, rates of heavier drinking, chronic heavier drinking, and in fact, drinking and driving. So this is deeply embedded in the culture of Wisconsin, as Maureen said. And again, it's not so much focusing on the percentage of people who consume alcohol. There are other states that have as many people who drink alcohol as Wisconsin, but it's this problem drinking behavior that we see in the state. And, you know, prevention and public health is really important, but also, as Maureen said, understanding the important effects of the culture and of the environment and of policies. So just one example is the beer tax in Wisconsin is the lowest in the nation by far. That's just a culture of an industry that influences policymakers so that, you know, we don't use that policy lever in this state to fund programs to promote prevention. And it's because of the longstanding relationship between industry and policymakers.
And Maureen, you've both used the word culture here, and I know a lot of your work over the years has been on changing the culture, the attitudes, the acceptance of unhealthy levels of drinking. Can you talk about successes maybe or the obstacles to those successes?
Well, again, I work with communities all over the state, and I do see a lot of progress and change happening. But it's one of those things where one policy, you know, say you've got a really strong festival policy and you're making sure that people are not overserved and there's no youth are allowed into the areas where alcohol is served. It's one piece of a bigger picture.
Maureen, I want to stay with you on the idea of what constitutes a lot of drinking. And I remember years ago after a conversation here on WPR about binge drinking, and a listener comment was something like, well, if you define binge drinking as 5 or 6 drinks, well, of course, we're all binge drinking, right? That's Thursday after work. The baseline, the anchor for a lot of people is much higher than is healthy, it seems to me. How do you start to move that needle?
Well, I think there's several approaches folks can take. One is just consciously drinking less, you know, so taking at least one serving off and working through that. We also think about alcohol-free days. So just like meatless Mondays, right? You know, we encourage people to not drink every day of the week. And then when you look at the science, you know, we have to say, especially because of the link to cancer, that there's really no safe level. But, you know, we live in a culture where alcohol is a part of everything. And so when we look at the research and the science that's been done, especially recently, we know that it's less than a drink a day for women and a drink a day or less for men. And so, and it's not that you can hold that and just drink all 7 on Friday night, right? It's really about that daily consumption. And that's really hard. It's a big, big change. And so that's why we encourage taking steps to reduce it. When I talk to providers, they tell me that, you know, a lot of these young people, they're drinking 2, 3, maybe more a night, not realizing how much of an issue that is. And I think, you know, there's this perception of someone who has an alcohol use disorder, you know, that they're falling down drunk, that relationships are a problem, jobs are a problem. And that's not necessarily the case, you know, with these folks who are drinking 2 or 3 or more every day, you know, and so they don't realize the harm that is happening. So I think it's a combination of, you know, understanding and, you know, thinking about how you approach alcohol use in your community, in your family, and also looking at different policies that can help make a difference.
Dr. Remington, I want to take this into the doctor's office now. What kind of role can care providers, primary care providers in particular, have in helping patients recognize problematic levels of drinking and then reducing it?
You know, the policy environment and the culture are incredibly important, and they're what we call strong determinants of the health of a community, and they influence alcohol consumption patterns tremendously. But the doctor's office is a special place where individual advice can be given to people. The physician can get to know the patient, sort of understand their behaviors, understand the reasons people drink, and then try and move that needle. And one approach is to ask people who are moderate drinkers to cut back. And the strategies that Maureen mentioned have been shown to be effective. This is really called the sort of counseling and with advice. It's like a motivational interview. You ask about alcohol consumption patterns, and then you follow that with advice. So I think just also increasing the awareness of the potential harms. I don't think it was the 1950s and 60s when people began to understand that cigarettes were harmful to health. And it took 40 or more years to implement the policies that were needed, like clean indoor air policies or not allowing smoking in restaurants and bars. I think we're in that sort of transition with alcohol, better understanding the harms. And there's, as Maureen said, no safe level. Clearly, there are low levels, which the harms are minimized and social benefits exist, and people will make that choice to drink some. But doing so in small amounts balances that harm with the benefits that everybody perceives. So I would say have a conversation with your primary care provider. The first issue in any concern is to understand if there is a problem. And I think that's the importance of having that conversation with your physician. And then once you understand that there may be a drinking problem, then set out on specific strategies to address that.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Maureen, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Maureen Buzalaki is director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project and the Division of Alcohol Policy Prevention and Research at the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And Dr. Patrick Remington is an emeritus professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We've been looking at the rise in recent years in alcohol-related liver deaths, especially among young people. And we want to hear your thoughts on the drinking culture here in Wisconsin. Do you think we drink too much? Do you feel pressure to drink more than you would like to? Have you seen some good no-alcohol alternatives when you go out? If you moved here from another state, were you surprised by what you saw in Wisconsin? Email us. The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, a new Farm Film and Culture Festival brings a series of independent movies to Wausau.
All of these are centered on rural areas and villages and small towns. I hope it inspires future filmmakers to find stories that are compelling and engaging.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Films from around the world will screen starting next weekend at a new film festival in Wausau.
North Central Technical College in Wausau is hosting its first ever Film, Farm, and Culture Fest, which will feature 8 different indie films exploring rural life and our relationship with the land.
Plus, the festival offers opportunities for attendees to learn some filmmaking skills.
Festival organizer Gila Nickpe is with us for a sneak preview. She's a Wisconsin filmmaker who teaches video production at North Central Technical College. Gila, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, this is exciting. First year of the Film, Farm, and Culture Fest. Can you give us the origin story? What led you to put this on?
Well, I always wanted to do a film festival at Wausau since I moved to Wausau 3.5 years ago. And there's a class that I teach to my students that prepare them for industry and film. And so, obviously, film festivals is one venue for showing your work. And although we are very technically oriented, where I teach at NTC, there's quite a few students that want to make their own short films. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes dream of making long films. And so I wanted to talk to them about film festival, what it is about, the history of it, and how they apply for it, and the benefits. And I was surprised. Most of my students did not have any idea what the film festival was. They kind of thought, well, there'll be some screening, of course. And I said, well, there's like labs. You can learn things. You can take classes. You submit your work, and if it's getting, you could get awards even, and you could meet with other filmmakers, mingle with them, network. You can find producers if your film is really cool, and there's lots of events around it, and it's a way to promote the city as well. So I they said, that's interesting. So I gave him an assignment to think about, like, what do they want to do with a film festival in Wausau? And that's the beginning, origin of it. And then I, you know, proposed this last year to our provost. And he said, okay, I'll let you do it, but I can't give you all the money you ask for.
No, and it's the Film Farm and Culture Fest. Can you talk about that theme and what goes into that idea?
Well, first of all, Wausau is in Midwestern town. Mm. There's 35,000 people, a small town. And its identity is rooted in Midwestern culture, which is agriculture, forestry, farming, and cattle ranching. So that's the idea. So work with identity of the place. And Wausau is very diverse, too, actually. So it's kind of bringing two sides of Wausau together.
And before we get into particular films, looking at the list as a whole, this is very diverse. These are films from around the world. But with this theme, there are things that people here in the Midwest, I think, can probably relate to. Can you talk about how you went about choosing the movies that would be screened over the course of the festival?
Yes. I started with the theme of our primal connection to the land, which is, of course, a multidimensional theme of both physical and spiritual connection to the land. Our identity is related to where we live. Our memories are part of the, you know, are held by the landscape and food that is provided through the land. We're nourished by it. We're inspired by the land that we live in. So that was the idea behind it. And then first I was really trying to find films that were happen on the farm, but that was very, very limited. So I began thinking, like, if our rural areas focus on films that happen on rural areas and small towns and villages around the world, would help me to find more of a diverse collection. And that's how I started looking from that lens, trying to select the films for the festival.
Now, one of the English language ones you have is called Rowdy Girl, a documentary film about a former cattle rancher who goes vegan, eventually transforms her husband's beef operation into a farm animal sanctuary. Here's a listen from the trailer to Rowdy Girl.
Because we used to be cattle ranchers, we are the bridge to save not just cows, but the planet. All species. If we are not here to do that, then what are we doing?
As you mentioned, Wisconsin, a dairy state, this documentary about veganism could be a real conversation starter, to put it mildly. Could you talk about this movie and why it made the cut for the festival?
Well, first of all, because she was an unusual character. Most of these independent films are that I chosen, they're, of course, been in festival circuits and have lots of awards. And so that was one reason that it's quite a few awards. And also the fact that it, you know, the character was very compelling and interesting, and the fact that it happened on the farm. And, you know, Wausau area, people love meat, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, this would be interesting, spark conversation about whether, you know, we should eat animals or not.
Now, another film, this one from Azerbaijan, The Return of the Projectionist, another documentary here. And there's a former film projectionist trying to revive cinema in a rural community. Do you see parallels with what you're doing in Wausau?
Yes. In fact, I really identified with the character. So, yeah, he brings this, has this old projector, and then the big part of the film is trying to find a bulb for it and trying to find a cinema. And those are the things I was struggling with, you know, trying to find the right venue that's centrally located. And, of course, I found Woodson History Center, which is lovely. So he finds a place, gets his projector going, and then has to advertise for it. And he goes door to door and talk to people and finally find an ally, a young man who's an animator. And then they, together, they project a film for the audience.
We're talking about the first ever Film Farm and Culture Fest taking place in Wausau starting next weekend, hosted by North Central Technical College, going to feature 8 different independent films and a lot of filmmaking workshops. Gila Nickpay is organizing the festival. She's a Wisconsin filmmaker who teaches video production at the college. I want to visit another movie in the lineup here. This one's called The Outpost, a man attempting to save part of the Amazon rainforest from wildfire by getting the attention of the Brazilian government. He's going to do it by trying to host a Pink Floyd concert in the middle of the forest. And here's activist Christopher Clark in one scene trying to get in touch with Pink Floyd's David Gilmour.
Hi, David. I'm sending you this from the middle of the Amazon rainforest, one of the most remote places in the world, the Shishio Reserve.
He's there. Anybody out there?
What was special? What stood out to you about this film as part of the festival?
Well, like all the films I've chosen, the character is fascinating. Christopher Clark is an activist and eco-activist that had a spiritual awakening when he was in Amazon rainforest. He was for 3 days lost. And after that, he left his home country. He actually was living in Italy at that time and came to Amazon of a rainforest, a village of Shishoa, and he created a kind of collective with the native people. He wanted to be self-sustained, and it was kind of like a little utopia. And what I liked about the film is that it wasn't as smooth, like everything goes the way Christopher Clark wants. So he had some sort of conflicts over the years. The natives weren't completely aligned with his vision. So I think that's what made this story very interesting and intriguing, and as far as the documentary goes.
Now, we focused on a few of the documentaries, the films you'll be showing there. But as you mentioned earlier, another part of this festival is helping people develop filmmaking skills, workshops, labs. What kind of things are going on?
So we have 4 labs. Some of them are storytelling-based, like short narrative production and documentary, and some of them are studio production, like creating a commercial. And some one is the last one is post-production for creating motion graphics. So we have those on our campus on Wausau main campus. And our facility is very complex in terms of equipment, professional equipment we have, and a lab and a studio that is equipped with like visual effects equipment and back green screen and LCD background. So it's a very intriguing place to learn hands-on. So these hands-on skills, and we wanted to offer them so people get introduced to our video program, and also anyone from community who wants to like register and continue with our associate degree, this is a good opportunity for them to get acquainted with our program and resources that we have, excellent resources that we have.
Now, people might think, okay, I want to go see international movies at a film festival. I got to go to the big city. I want to learn how to become a filmmaker. I got to go to the big city. Make the case that, no, we can do these things in Marathon County.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly one of the reasons I chose these independent films, because all of these are centered on rural areas and villages and small towns. So I hope it inspire future filmmakers to want to look around a little bit more carefully to find stories that are compelling and engaging right in Wausau and surrounding.
I understand one of your concerns, a wider concern, is support for arts here in Wisconsin. You came, I think you mentioned, from Minnesota. Compare and contrast. What do you see when it comes to support for the arts?
So as a filmmaker and artist, I live in Minneapolis for a long time. I was recipient many awards. My films were shown in Walker Arts Center, Minneapolis International Film Festival, and many other venues. So Minnesota spends about almost $10 per capita on arts. And so that really is helpful for growth of an artist. Without that, resources are for filmmaking or creating art aren't very easily available. So when I came to Wisconsin, it took me a while to find out that there is no grants or support for individual artists. And I was shocked first. And then I researched it and I found out that in Wisconsin, they spend only 18 cents per capita for arts. So I was shocked, really, honestly. And so I thought, well, maybe it's we as people were already exposed to this generosity of art grants and fellowship. Maybe it's our responsibility to bring it to us.
Now, what are your hopes when the festival is done? I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but what are your hopes for the idea of building a film community of viewers and maybe creators in Wausau growing from this festival?
Well, I'm in a very unique position at NTC because we have really great equipment and facilities at NTC. Okay, and so, and having the background as an artist, lived as a filmmaker and artist, active artist in Minneapolis. So I feel like I'm in a unique place to initiate what I call Film Fan Hub. And that's initiative I'm hoping bring the film lovers, independent film lovers, and independent filmmakers together for support and exchange of ideas. And hopefully we'll grow to a point where we have lots of activities as well.
And then this is the first annual Film, Farm, and Culture Fest. I assume you have thoughts of a second annual Film, Farm, and Culture Fest. Are you starting to get the wheels in motion for that already?
Well, it is a pilot program, and I think the NTC is excited about it, but and I think they will renew it, but we'll see. Hopefully, there are a lot of people who want to see these lovely films.
And for people in the community, do you want to give a little invite to check out the movies, even if they're not directly involved in film production themselves?
I wanted to say that these films, the independent films that I have selected, are from four different continents, and they are all have compelling characters and fascinating stories that happen in rural areas. And so by coming to this festival, you learn new knowledge, hopefully, and the films would be entertaining to you, and as well as spark conversation. And hopefully we will push independent filmmaking a little further in Wausau.
Sheila, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Sheila Nickpay is a Wisconsin filmmaker who teaches video production at North Central Technical College in Wausau. She's organizing the college's first ever Film, Farm, and Culture Fest that starts next weekend. It'll feature eight different independent films and several filmmaking workshops.
Libraries are at the center of so many communities, and on Friday we'll be learning about how the Carnegie Libraries that were built in Superior are now up for sale and one is in rough shape. A local historian and retired librarian is sharing their history.
And you can join in with your memories of your own library growing up or how the library is part of your life now. What do you depend on from your library? What kind of materials do you check out? If it's one of the dozens of Carnegie Libraries in Wisconsin, does the building itself hold a special significance for you?
Share your story about the contributions of libraries, and we hope to use your comments on a future program. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. And thanks so much for reaching out and being part of the program.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Trevor Hook, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.